leave the wilderness of living entities. It's more that the Lord does not like that the living entities themselves come to that position of their own volition. You know, Prabhupada gave the example of the prison house. The prisoners. Now, the people who built the prison house, the people who are running the prison house, they might feel ashamed that, you know, we have to lock all these people up and the government is not happy. All these people have to be locked up. But it's not their fault. It's not the fault of the authorities in the prison that they have to lock the people up. They may feel bad about it, the authorities, but actually it's the fault of the criminals. So it's not Maya's fault. But because she is a very sensitive type of person, therefore she doesn't like it. It's just like, you know, there were occasions when Prabhupada chastised some disciple and then afterwards apologized. Yeah. So why did he chastise him? Not because he lost his temper or something, you know, some fault on his part. He's just trying to help them. It's an act of mercy, but still, because he's a very sensitive person, then he doesn't feel that, yes, I like chastising these people. It's not like that. So therefore, some feeling may be there of regret. So Maya feels like that. She feels some regret, but at the same time, because she is a great devotee, when she sees that these jivas, they are big rascals, then she thinks, yes, I'm going to just teach them a lesson. One way or the other, I'll show them that their position is wrong. So that is what is mentioned about the position of Maya here. Let us go on to 33, which is discussing Maya, her part in the whole picture. And it's more or less elaborating on what we've discussed just now. 33.1, for his part, the Supreme Lord cannot withdraw his favor from Maya, whom he has delegated as the controller of the material creation, and who has always been his devotee. So, he is not upset with Maya. He is not about to, you know, sort of punish her or something like that. Still, he wants the jivas to turn favorably toward him, even if they must do so out of fear of Maya. So whatever it takes, practically, even if they have to be kicked back, even if, you know, even if they have to go through the school of hard knocks, if that's what it takes, you know, by the intervention of Maya, then let it be that. But one way or other, let's have them come back. The Lord is feeling like that. So therefore he instructs in Bhagavad Gita 7.14, this divine energy of mind consisting of the three modes of material nature is very difficult to overcome. But to those who have surrendered unto me can easily cross beyond it. Yeah. So it's very difficult. But then, so that is looking at it from the point of view of those who have to be kicked back to Godhead, or at least kicked back onto the path back to Godhead, put it that way. But actually what he would really like is expressed in this Bhagavatam verse quoted next, famous verse 325.25, Satam Prasangang Mama Virya Samvido, very famous verse. In the association of pure devotees, discussion of the pastimes and activities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is very pleasing and satisfying to the ear and the heart. By cultivating such knowledge, a person gradually becomes advanced on the path of liberation, and thereafter he is freed and his attraction becomes fixed. Then real devotion and devotional service begin. So this is more like, you know, this is what it should be like. Someone gets some good association and they hear about Krishna, they become inspired. So they take to Krishna consciousness. The Lord would like that very much. But sometimes they need to be kicked. And then they realize, oh, okay, better hear and chant about Krishna then. But then they come to the same point anyway. Eventually they'll come to the same point. It would be nice if they took to it on that basis. But many of them, they'll only take to it after they've been kicked by Maya. So ultimately then Maya, her duty is to facilitate that. So it's good. How could she lose the favor of the Lord? It wouldn't be like that. She's always his devotee. And then real devotion and devotional service begin when the devotee's attraction becomes fixed, when he becomes advanced on the path of liberation, thereafter he's freed. In other words, the devotee has become a little advanced, right? But it says that then real devotion and devotional service begin. So we have not, I have not, come to the level of being advanced on the path of liberation, freed, attraction completely fixed. I don't know about any of you. So does that mean that none of us have come to the level of real devotional service? Are we just doing some sort of, you know, some foolish thing or some unreal thing? This is real devotional service. Are we doing unreal devotional service? It's not really that. We are practicing. We are learning and practicing. It's something like the difference between a person learning to drive a motor car and, you know, they're meant to change gear, but they've put their foot on the brake. Whoops, missed the clutch. Or else they put their foot on the accelerator. You tell them to turn to the left, they turn to the right. Or they change gear and then the car sort of leaps forward as they release the clutch too quickly. Or put their foot on the brake and you just go through the window. Something like that. So it's not real driving, in a sense. Not like a real driver who can handle everything. So it's not real driving, but at the same time, you can't say that it's not driving. It's just a preliminary stage. It is the same thing, just as much as a green mango and a ripe mango are the same thing. Yeah, you cannot say they're not the same thing. But at the same time, there is a difference. And the difference will be quite obvious if you taste them. So it's like this. This is achintya bhed abhed tattva, one and different. It is devotional service. You cannot say that it is not devotional service. It's material. It's maya. It's an illusion. It's something which is not real. It is real. But it's not like that. Advanced, liberated, fixed devotional service, absorbed in attraction to the Lord. Come to that. We're going to discuss Anathopasamam Sakshad in due course of time. All these things are going to be discussed at length. The realization of Vyas. Yeah. Okay, 33.2. In his pastime form of Sri Vyas, the Lord has very explicitly instructed the living beings in this way. In other words, that they should surrender it to him so they can transcend Maya. This we shall see shortly in our discussion of the verse beginning. Anathopashamam Sakshad. You see, it'll come. That's the following verse, 176. Thus, both the Lord and Maya have acted quite properly. This is the point. I mean, this is a point here. That Maya, even though she's ashamed, is just a manifestation of her humble nature as a devotee. She has nothing to be ashamed of. And she's not going to be rejected by the Lord or something like that for the way she treats the jivas. It is proper. And the way that the Lord relates to her is also proper. So now there's a little change of subject to some extent, just to clarify who Maya is. What is Maya, actually? But one may object, if Maya is only an energy, and an energy is the capacity to do some work, and is moreover just a quality possessed by some entity, how then can Maya feel ashamed? can have other similar characteristics. If she's only an energy, the illusory energy. The answer is that although Maya is in fact an energy, we do hear from the Vedic scriptures about female deities, and male deities for that matter, who preside over energies, but it's mainly female in deities actually, who preside over energies residing in the Supreme Lord. We see an example of this in the dialogue between Lord Indra and Maya herself in the Kena Upanishad. In any case, we should now let this matter stand and return to the main topic of our discussion. So, this is an interesting point, that Maya is not just an energy only. Maya is an energy, but there is a person, a deity, who is directing that energy. That is Maya Devi. And this story that he's referring to here from Kena Upanishad is an interesting story in which the demigods are fighting the demons. And they're really struggling. But then the Supreme Personality of Godhead intervenes and empowers the demigods. And the demigods win, headed by Indra. So when they win, though, the demigods become puffed up and think, you know, we won. We're really powerful people. We won. And they forgot about the Lord. So then the Lord himself, in order to teach the demigods a lesson, he incarnated as a yaksha, kind of supernatural type of being, who is, anyway, in a kind of unusual position, sometimes identified with the demigods, sometimes kind of in-between position, like that, the yakshas. So he incarnated as a yaksha, and he came with a blade of grass, and the demigods couldn't identify, who is this person who just walked in here? So they send Agni to find out, who is this yaksha? So Agni asked, who are you? And the yaksha said, the Supreme Lord said, if you want to know, then try to destroy this blade of grass. So Agni, who's the presiding deity of fire, tried to burn the grass. He couldn't do it. Then Vayu was sent. And Vayu said the same thing. You tell us who you are. And the Lord, as the yaksha, said, okay, but you try and blow this out of my hand, this blade of grass. So Vayu, the deity of air, of wind, tried to blow it out of the Lord's hand. He couldn't. So then Lord Indra himself came, who is the supreme demigod, after Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. He came and said, all right, you please tell me who you are. Then the yaksha disappeared, and Maya Devi appeared in the form of Uma. Uma Devi is a form of Durga, of Maya. And she explained that that yaksha was the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And just as you didn't have the power to defeat him then in this very small matter, so you're subordinate to him, so you should understand that in that battle, you were simply empowered by him, you're subordinate to him. So in this way, Indra and the demigods became corrected. So Uma, this female deity of the material energy, she personally appeared before them. So this is a proof that Maya, even though an energy, is not simply an energy. There is a presiding and controlling deity of that Maya. That is Maya. That is Durga. All right. So now we go into a different section. This is a very different section. This is a completely different subsection, actually, where Jiva Goswami, he is now going to apply the understandings which we have developed through appreciating the realizations of Shukadeva and Vyas. He is now going to apply those understandings to the theories of the Mayavadis, and see how the theories of the Mayavadis stand up against them. And unfortunately for the Mayavadis, their theories don't stand up very well in the light of the realization, particularly of the realization of Vyas, which is kind of a detailed, it's a more detailed realization, or at least the description is more detailed than that of Shukadeva. So now we get a series of short verses in which different points from the Mayavad philosophy are presented and then defeated. So the subsection is from text 34 to 43, and it's titled Sambandha. So we are now to understand Sambandha, the relationship between the Lord and the living entity, Sambandha in that sense, and Sambandha in the sense of the relationship of the book, the meaning of the book with the subject, the absolute truth. What does the book say? What does the book say about the absolute truth? Yeah. Okay, so text 34, just a very short little verse. Like the jiva, like the Lord, the jiva is purely spiritual. Yet still he is different from the Lord. This truth is indicated by the words tad apashrayam, that maya, that's maya of course, not the living entities at this point, but maya is outside him, yet supported by him. So maya was seen as independent of the Lord, but dependent upon the Lord, not one with. That was 174, and then 175, which we've been discussing quite a bit today. It said, yayasamohito, that the living entities are deluded by maya. So, in this way, we see that the jivas are one in quality being purely spiritual, but still different. Because maya was there, and there were those jivas bewildered by maya. So even though they're spiritual, they're bewildered. That's a fairly simple point. And in the commentary there, we mentioned Baladev Vijayabhushan's commentary on this verse. So he says that Vyas also saw time. How does he know that? Because the influence of time is expressed by three statements. Apasyat, he saw. Sammohita, he is bewildered. And Manute, he considers. So the existence of time is basically understood there. Because to become bewildered, you need a little time. To see something, you know, like to really see it clearly, because he really saw it very clearly. Apasyat purusham purna. To see it, it takes a little time. Then samohita, the jivas, he saw them becoming bewildered, takes a little time. And Manute, having become bewildered, that they then consider that, oh, look, I am now my body. So it also takes a little time. So there is some time involved in these different experiential phenomena. So therefore, this is another, understood point. That we can understand that even though it's not directly stated, but Vyas saw time. Just like it's understood that he saw the internal potency. He must have. So then, text 35. Now we're going to get into some Mayavad. If it is indeed true that the one undivided Brahman, whose very nature is pure spirit, so if it is true that Brahman, which is completely spiritual, is also the foundation of material illusion and also embodies the liberating force of knowledge. You got it? This is all. Yes, Mayavad is not easy to digest. Then what follows is that it is illogical to say that Brahman falls under Maya's influence and is overcome by ignorance. Do you get that idea? If that Brahman, that one undivided Brahman, which is pure spirit, and is the foundation of material illusion, means is supporting it, and it also embodies that very thing which can liberate those who have fallen into illusion, then how could that Brahman fall into illusion? Right? Because it is liberated to start off with. That's the first point. It is undivided. It is pure spirit. Its very nature is pure spirit. Only, it has no other nature. It is supporting illusion. Illusion is dependent upon it. And it embodies the potency to become free from illusion. So how could that Brahman fall into illusion? That is illogical. That is illogical, isn't it? It's quite illogical. So, thus, now going back to Vyasa's realization, thus we can understand that it is only reasonable that the jivas who fall into illusion and the Supreme Lord who cannot fall into illusion and who indeed is the very person who can deliver through transcendental knowledge, they're separate. They must be separate. And according to Vyas, that's what he saw. So in this way, Vyas has contradicted the Mayavadis, but the Mayavadis have just got themselves confused, really. Since both their identities and their capabilities are different, the jiva and the Lord are essentially distinct. How does that sound? Is that okay? Sounds pretty reasonable, doesn't it? Yeah. So the Lord falls into illusion as Krishna. Yes, he appears. He falls under yoga maya. But at the same time, you know, he's not an illusion. That is his... See, if you say he can fall into illusion, and then he becomes limited by that, then now you've really limited him. So he is unlimited in that he can fall into illusion. But at the same time, he's not an illusion. Just see. That's a Chintya Bheda Bhed. That's a Chintya Bheda Bhed. Yes. Okay, let us just carry on. Text 36. Also, the Mayavadis cannot explain this difference between the jiva and the Lord simply as a division or reflection of Brahman into a hierarchy of upadis. So now we're getting into some little technical areas. You see here in this text 36, it refers to that there are different sorts of Mayavadis, of course. The Mayavadis are not all one. There are different types of Mayavadis. And the main two types are referred to here. Those who think that the difference between the jiva and the Lord, or the jiva and Brahman, that exists, there are those who think that the difference is there because there is a division of Brahman. Brahman has been divided up. And so they are called the Pariched Vadis. Pariched means the philosophy of division of Brahman. Then there are those who think that Brahman has just become reflected. They are called the Pratibimba Vadis. Okay, now, just to explain what these two concepts involve. Parichet, the theory of the division of Brahman. That the classic example is of the pot, empty pot, which there is sky within and without of. So the sky within the pot and the sky outside of the pot, they're the same sky. This pot has just come along and imposed itself. But if you take the pot away, then you just have the same sky. So the sky has become divided, the one sky. There remains one sky. There always was one sky. Then along came the division, the pot. But it's still just the one sky. But some of the sky is now in the pot. And some is outside. But it's the same sky. It's not that the pot has its own sky. No, it's just dividing the existing sky. And when you take away the pot, it is not now that you have more sky. You've just got the same sky again. So this is the sort of fundamental concept of Parichedvad, the apparent or the division. It may be apparent, it may be real. There are subdivisions. Some think that the division is real. Some think that the division is not real. That we're going to discuss in due course of time. The question is that if Mayavad philosophy is that it is all one, where did the pot come from to divide Brahman? Well, this is the point. How to figure out the apparent, this situation which we see around us now. How do we understand that? Yeah. So the Mayavadis, they go through great mental convulsions, practically, to try to explain how it has come about that we see what we see, when it is all one, actually. Yeah. And, you know, we have to revert back from this state to that state of it all being one. So what happens when, as we go through that process of liberation also? So these things are going to be discussed. I'm just saying now what are the fundamental, very fundamental concepts. So that is the concept of division of Brahman. In other words, it doesn't affect Brahman. The Brahman remains the same. But the division, the pot, is the upadi. Now, as I said, there are some who think that the pot may be real. And some who think that the pot may actually not exist, but it is simply a figment of the imagination, an imagination which also does not exist, because it's all one. There's nothing other than Brahman. So anyway, it's not easy for them. And Jiva Goswami really kind of makes the most of that over the next few verses. Then Pratibimbavad, what is that? The theory of reflection. So the theory of reflection means that if you have a whole lot of pots of water and you have one moon in the sky, then that one moon can be reflected many times in the many pots. So you may think you have many moons. So what are the pots in this example? I mean, in the division example, the pot is the body or the subtle body like that. I should have mentioned that. In Parichedvad, the theory of division, that pot which has apparently divided the sky into the sky outside the pot and the sky inside the pot, that is the body. Or even more particularly, perhaps, the subtle body. Now, in the example of reflection, again, the pots are the body, or the subtle body. So, you have the one Brahman reflected in many parts. You appear to have many Brahmans, but you actually only have one Brahman. You see? So in this way they think they have themselves covered, that it's all one, even though there appears to be many. Yeah. Anyway, the intricacies of that, you know, where did the pots come from? What part do they play in the whole picture if it's all one, if it's really meant to be all one? That we're going to come to shortly. I think we can just leave it here for today. And I really think strongly that you should read on if you haven't done. How many of you did read on? How Jiva Goswami defeats Mayavad in a few verses and establishes the Sambandha, the real Sambandha, that there are the Jivas, there is the Lord, and they are related as independent, qualitatively the same, but they're individually independent living entities. Not absolutely independent, of course, but there is this independence of entity there which exists as a reality. This is the Sambandha. And this is not only the Sambandha in a philosophical sense, but this is the Sambandha in terms of Srimad Bhagavatam and how it relates with its subject, which is Krishna. Yeah. There's this word anadi. Adi means beginning, anadi means without beginning, literally. And the word is being used in terms here of the jiva situation in material life. Srila Prabhupada's presentation of what this word implies or indicates is that we've been in the material world since time immemorial, since a time untraceable. Not necessarily specifically, actually beginninglessly. In other words, there really was no beginning at all, permanently. Not in that sense. And so that's Prabhupada's basic expression. And that is, you know, in conformity with different verses like spoken by Lord Chaitanya, for example, in Chaitanya Charitamrita, talking about Krishna Bahir Mukya, Mukha Jiva Bhoga Vanchakari, how the living entity turned his back on Krishna and then fell into illusion. Or like Jiva Goswami explains in the first verse of Bhakti Sandarbha, that because of the crime of being averse to the Lord, the living entity was placed in material life and received a material body, and then as a result received material miseries. So in conformity with statements like that, Prabhupada presented anadi as meaning from time immemorial. Actually, an interesting point Prabhupada also made is that time as we know it, in between creations, ceases. So therefore, in the sense of time, as in any way that we could conceive of it possibly, in that sense, the living entities period within the material world is beyond the possibility of applying time, the concept of time as we know, to it. So therefore the concept of time immemorial is appropriate. But beginningless, you know, is like a very particular type of concept. And that is not really supported. Anyway, we all know where that could take us to in terms of discussions and writing or reading books. So we don't want to really get into it. But I'm just saying that that's how Prabhupada presented anadi, and we will work on that basis. Time ago, you can't say how long, so therefore you just say from time immemorial. That's what it means. You cannot say, but it's been an awfully long time. Yeah. Jai Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we began yesterday our discussion about the refutation of Mayavad. Srila Jiva Goswami basically is applying what we've learnt from the first two verses from the seventh chapter of the first canto, the first two verses dealing with Vyasa's trance, that is 174 and 5. First canto, chapter 7, verses 4 and 5, describing how he realized Krishna and how he saw the living entities and Maya. So this description then that we're reading through now, from verse 34 through to about verse 43, I think, they are mainly based on those verses, the refutations being offered of the Mayavad philosophy. So, as far as Mayavad itself is concerned, we mentioned yesterday that there are two very prominent forms of Mayavad, Parichayad and Pratibimba. Parichayad means that Brahman has become divided by upadis, and Pratibimba means that Brahman has become reflected in upadis, by upadis, in upadis, and externally has apparently assumed the forms of those upadis. So on the board today, we have written just a few little words of explanation there. Whether the Mayavadi, these two varieties of Mayavadi, whether they think Brahman has been divided or reflected, they all agree, the classic Mayavadis at least, they all agree that it has been either divided or reflected into these things. Yeah. It's just the procedure which they may differ on, division or reflection. But the specific upadis, those illusory, conditioning, limiting things which are covering and apparently taking the place of Brahman, they're the same. So they're written up on the board there. There's five factors, basically. First is avidya. Somehow, Brahman, or some part of Brahman, becomes affected by avidya. Avidya means ignorance. Under the influence of that ignorance, that part of Brahman thinks that he, she, or it, or whatever, is now a jiva. And then enters into a state based on that influence of ignorance, enters into a state of illusion, Maya. Then, following that, not before, but the next stage is that another part of Brahman becomes covered, this time by goodness, and becomes like a very high level upadi, a high level illusory concept or illusory non-existent, well anyway, existent or non-existent, that is a subject we're going to be looking at, but an entity or category of entity called the Ishvara category. That means what, this is all according to the Mayavadis, of course, particularly Shankaracharya, what we would normally call God or the Vishnu Tattva. This Ishvara category of upadi is not transcendental as we would say the Vishnu Tattva is, the Ishvara Tattva, but almost transcendental, but not quite, on a very high level of the mode of goodness. And as such, even though that part of Brahman, in order to have become the Ishvara, has been influenced by Maya. But that influence of Maya has been, it's more like voluntarily accepted. So that Ishvara is generally considered by the Mayavadis to not really be so much, if at all, or hardly at all, influenced by Maya. In fact, generally, it is controlling Maya. Yeah. The Ishvara principle is controlling Maya and controlling the living entities also through Maya, through their karma. And that Ishvara possesses the fifth principle, which is vidya, or knowledge. And through that knowledge, the jivas can realize that they are Brahman, and then they can just realize they're Brahman. Not exactly a return, as we would say, in a kind of the sense of a geographical change of position, go back to Godhead, but just realize. Yes, it's like this. There are many different types of Mayavadis. They may have different ideas about Krishna. But the classical Mayavadis, they see Krishna as part of the Ishvara Tattva, Ishvara category. Yeah. The embodiment of goodness, the embodiment of knowledge. Somehow Brahman has accepted that position due to the influence of Maya, but is not really under the control of Maya. So therefore they're able to liberate others or help others to become liberated. Yeah. That's part of it, yeah. Panchapasana, worshipping. It generally means the Vishnu Tattva. It may include some demigods, some big demigods. So this is the basic sort of picture that the Mayavadis have of what happens to Brahman, the different manifestations which, when we think of the material world, this is what has happened, this is what has gone on. Brahman has either been divided into these different categories or is being reflected. But one way or another, there are these five. So, we are just speaking in very simple and very general terms here. Yeah, we're not attempting to go into the intricacies of it. Some of it may not appear so clear, actually, so easily understandable. The reason for that is that it cannot be understood like this, because it isn't true, and it is a manifestation of the confusion of the Mayavadis. Therefore, if it doesn't make good sense to you, that's probably good. And if you think, yes, this is the way it is, then maybe you're a Mayavadi. Okay. Right, so we read then of these verses dealing with Mayavad. Yesterday we read 34, 35, and 36. 34 was really just an introduction. In fact, it's just an introduction. It's nothing to do with like a statement as far as Mayavad is concerned. 35 is a very clear statement about Mayavad. And we talked about this yesterday. How Mayavad, on a very fundamental level, this is a very basic type of picture of what Mayavad is trying to put across, but how it doesn't make sense. This, of course, is Jiva Goswami's idea to explain to us how it doesn't make sense. So here in 35, he's saying, on a very fundamental level, it doesn't make sense. That if there is only one Brahman, it is not only is it all-pervading, it cannot be divided, even if you tried. It couldn't be divided. It couldn't be degraded materially.
because it's completely pure spirit. Somehow or other, it is the foundation of material illusion. It is not affected by it, but it is the foundation of it. But it also embodies knowledge, which is what you can become liberated through. So, this is like a fundamental picture of what they're trying to say, on a very simple level. So he says, if all this is true, and they say it is, then it is not logical that Brahman could fall into Maya. Part of Brahman, a reflection of it, a divided part of it, and become the jiva. It wouldn't be possible if Brahman is really like that. So then in 36, he just tells us about these two types of Mayavadis, those who think that Brahman has become divided, and those who think that it has become reflected. So let us now go on with 37. And he is now going to explain further the defects. Whether you are on the Parichet side or Pratibimba side doesn't make a big difference. But the basic point is that these upadis that we've written on the board are there somehow or other. So first of all, he starts off by saying in 37, if we assume that these upadis are empirically real and not illusory, this is a very important point or beginning place. If we are to say that these upadis written on the board here are real, they actually exist, and they're not illusions, still, because Brahman is not affected by anything, it cannot be delimited by them or divided. It cannot be divided by them because Brahman is Brahman. Moreover, if you're on the Pratibimba side, the reflective side, Brahman can cast no reflection because it is devoid of attributes. It is all-pervading and it is indivisible. Since Brahman has no attributes, it can have no relation with upadis. Since it is all-pervading, it cannot be divided into a reflected object and its reflection. And since it is indivisible and uniform, it cannot be seen. In these respects, Brahman resembles the sky. Because the sky is invisible, reflections are cast not by the sky itself, but by limited, luminous parts of the sky. In fact, I don't really like that. By limited, luminous things in the sky. Namely, the heavenly bodies or planets or stars like that. So they are not part of the sky, they're in the sky. Yeah. So in our commentary here, the point is, first of all, we are considering if the upadis are real. Those things which divide. In other words, our bodies. Our bodies, we said yesterday, in the dividing parichet concept, they're like the pots. The sky is in the pot and outside the pot. The sky inside is not different from the sky outside. And if we think that it is because the pot is there, and now the sky has somehow or other assumed some different condition, is now a different entity from what it was, because the pot is there, well, that's not correct. As soon as you take the pot away, you see it's the same sky. Yeah. So these bodies, if we say the upadis are real, then that means that these bodies are real. That is what we're saying. Or in the reflective concept, then it means that that one Brahman is being reflected into many pots of water, and those pots of water do exist. And they are then the bodies. Okay, so, in our commentary we say, defeating Parichedvad and Pratibimbavad, if the upadis are real. So, first thing is that, even if the upadis are real, but Brahman is transcendental, so it can't be limited by them. If you say it can that they're actually real, And Brahman actually becomes divided by them and actually becomes limited to them, then you are denying the fundamental definition of what is Brahman. Brahman cannot be limited by these things. So, then, it has the second point in the commentary, it is that it has no form, so it cannot be reflected. And these further points about it has no attributes. So it cannot have any relation with upadis. It is all pervading. It cannot be divided into a reflected object and its reflection. It's indivisible and uniform. It cannot be seen. So this is all kind of related to this concept he introduces at the end, that in these respects, Brahman is like the sky. How can you reflect the sky if you take a mirror? You cannot reflect the sky. It is not like that, because it doesn't have attributes of that nature. So it's unreflectable. It cannot be reflected also, because it's all pervading. In other words, it is basically everything. Then you cannot reflect it, because you could only reflect it in itself if it's actually all pervading. So that doesn't make sense either. And it has no attributes at all, as we understand attributes. It is simply all-pervading, formless, indivisible. It is just oneness, spiritual oneness. So it has no upadis. It cannot have any upadis. So like this, it can be compared to the sky. This is if the upadis are real. And then 38. Moreover, if there were empirically real upadis, delimiting Brahman, Parichet, or acting as the medium of its reflection, Pratibimba, a person could not escape from them simply by knowing he is one with the Supreme in essence. And if the Advaita monists propose that freedom from upadis is due to the influence of the Supreme Entity who is called Tat, that, then they agree with us. This is a very interesting point. If the upadis are actually real, you really have a body. You are really in Maya. You are really in illusion. You are under the influence of the three modes, and they are real, and they have got a grip on you. Then it is not simply a matter of just saying that, well, I'm Brahman, I'm not part of this. Insufficient. That would be like saying, if you were really sick, you know, if you were really, really sick, completely knocked out, and someone comes and says, you're not sick! Pick up your bed and rise, or whatever it is. So then you try and stand up, yes, I'm not sick, but then you'll just fall over again. You know, some years ago in South Africa, there was some Christian evangelists who are doing so-called miracle programs in public, supposedly curing people who are sick. And they would bring people up onto the stage. But most of those people were their own people. They were just acting like they were sick. But then the South African national television came, and they brought someone who was crippled and said, okay, now you do it here, and televised. So they did their whole, you know, feverish thing of Jesus, this and that, and so on and so forth. Now throw away your crutches and walk. He threw away his crutches and fell flat on his face, unfortunately for him, on television. Because you cannot just say, it's not just a matter of knowing, oh yes, I'm in Maya. If the upadis are real, and if you are actually, really under their control, that it is not just a matter of knowledge. This is what they would say. It's just a matter of knowledge. You just know, oh yes, I am not all of that. But if it is real and your entangled position is real, then you have to deal with it by some real means. You cannot just talk your way out of it. And if that is the case, again, this is still 38, if we are assuming that the upadis are actually real, then you might, the Advaita monists might say that it is by the mercy of Brahman that you may get out of illusion. Then, indirectly, they are proposing pure Krishna consciousness, that there is a supreme entity who is capable of giving mercy, and if you appeal to that living entity, that entity, then he may give you mercy, and then you can be delivered. So indirectly, Jiva Goswami says that they are then agreeing with us, the devotees. So then on to 39. Now there's a discussion about if the upadis are not real. And generally, this is actually, from my understanding, more what the classic Mayavadis think, that the upadis are not real. Yeah. Although there are some who do think they are real. So, text 39. Conversely, if the upadis are only apparently real, they're not real, then Brahman's delimitation, being divided, parichedvad, or being reflected, pratibimbavad, are also only apparently real, since these processes would not in fact occur. Because in this case, the Mayavadi's doctrine would be based on the analogy of an unreal dream state, such analogies as that of the pot in the sky, which involve real upadis, cannot serve to establish it. No proper analogy can be drawn between something that exists and something that does not exist. Therefore, the Mayavadi's theories of division and reflection are nothing but the play of illusion, unprovable by their faulty application of analogies. So it is, the suggestion there is, if the upadis are not real, then it is something like dreaming. You may dream that a tiger is chasing you, so now you're in a world of fear. But actually, it's not happening at all. It doesn't even exist. So when you come out of that dream state, then that dream has no bearing at all on your reality. Has absolutely no bearing at all. Or you may dream, you may be very hungry. You may dream you're having a big feast. But when you come out of that dream, when you wake up, then that dream will have no bearing at all on your real condition. You'll still be hungry. So he's saying that if you say that the upadis are not real and the whole thing is a figment of the imagination, and that imagination is also not real, none of these things exist, then you end up in a situation where you cannot explain in real terms. You cannot present in real terms what is the position. So therefore you couldn't express it in meaningful ways. He says no proper analogy could be drawn then between those totally unreal things which don't exist and your actual real position.